Well, as we kick off the Advent sermon series, The Mysteries of Advent, would you turn in your copy of the scriptures, or you can look in your bulletin there, to Romans chapter 11. I'm going to start in verse 33 and read into 12:2. This is Advent. Preparing for Advent sermons as a pastor is always a little bit challenging because, you know, you're trying to come up with something else and you've done this enough years that you're like, oh, what am I going to do this year? And what is more Advent-y than Romans 11? Or maybe not, but I hope that it will fit. I have the privilege of kicking off the sermon series and hopefully tee some things up for the people coming after me. So that's what we're going to try to do this morning. Let's read starting in Romans 11, verse 33. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are His judgments, and how inscrutable His ways! For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been His counselor? Or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, speaking to the whole family of God, brothers and sisters, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. This is the word of the Lord. Well, I was thinking about this. My family went downtown and got to see the girls' basketball, the UW girls' basketball team play, so I've kind of a basketball on the brain. I think, Debbie, we might have seen you on the Jumbotron. It's true, so. But there we go. Well, you guys are missing out. You could have been there with us. It was like Lake Trails at the game. So I'm thinking basketball. I was thinking a little bit about my basketball coach when I was in high school. Coach Stogsdill. That's a good coaching name. We called him Stogs, of course. But Stogs, Coach Stogsdill, was very knowledgeable about the game of basketball. He had played some level of college. As far as we were concerned, he played at the highest level of college because he was Coach Stogsdill. He frequented coaching clinics. He watched a lot of games. He knew how basketball worked. Coach Stogsdill, we were convinced, knew basketball. So when he would talk to us in practice and tell us the ways of the game, we agreed. Of course we agreed. Coach Stogsdill's telling us, this is how you do a pick and roll. So we agreed because it's Coach Stogsdill. He knows. We were impressed with his ability to draw up a play in a huddle. In practices, he'd tell us what to do. We nodded along in full awareness. All of these things were happening because we knew Coach Stogsdill understood the game of basketball. Now, we thought he was a great coach, which kind of calls into question why in games it was like we had not heard a thing he said. Those times in the game when I know, as I maybe Jonathan was like pulling his hair out, like, why won't they block out? What? We talked about this in practice. It happened over and over again. It was as though all of the wisdom of Coach Stogsdill that we completely acknowledged and believed in our hearts was true was utterly disconnected by the way we played that game. Now, this passage can present a similar kind of scenario. Consider what this passage says about the wisdom of God. Starting in verse 33, it tells us that worship, it shows us, I should say, worshipful astonishment at what God knows. Right? Oh, the depth of riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. It's just, it's astonishment at God's wisdom. And if you look at verses 34 and 35, drawing from texts in Isaiah 40 and Job 41, it just speaks about how much God knows. Look at how much He knows. Who's known the mind of God? Who can scratch the surface on His wisdom? Who knows? Then you get to verse 36. Verse 36 speaks of God as this infinite access of all reality. All reality turns on God's infinite wisdom. God is revealing Himself in Christ, and His ways are so amazing, so glorious, so wise. But here's the thing, and we can do this during the Advent season when we're singing these. I mean, Lily said to me this morning, you know why I love Advent? Because we get to sing O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. Like, Is there a better song? If there is, it's kind of like pineapple. Like, if there's a better tasting fruit, I've never had it. If there's a better song than that, I've never heard it. I mean, it's amazing. And we can sing these songs, and they poke on parts of our heart that get at the sense of transcendence and mystery, and they're wonderful. And it's true. But why then, if we sing these songs and we feel all the feels about the wisdom and transcendence and wonder of God, why is it then that we get so frustrated with his ways? You know what I mean? We sing these things and, oh, God is so amazing, he's so wonderful, and then we get so frustrated and kind of angry when we want to do things and his ways say no. Or when he says, this is how life ought to be lived, and then we go, what? Why that disconnect? Perhaps a different way to say it is, if we believe all this stuff about how amazing and transcendent and wise God is, why is it that his ways seem to cut against the grain of everything we want to do? God's ways seems to cut against the grain of what we think is best. It seems to cut against the patterns of our age about how to gain influence or relate to people or have power or keep power or manage control. God's ways don't seem to agree with what we want a lot. God's ways don't agree with what our age identifies as the real problem in the world. I mean, our age does present a certain set of answers to the questions of life, but God's ways don't always agree with that, and we find that so utterly frustrating. Why would God tell us to do those things? Our age does offer up some answers to the questions of our hearts, and we become so inundated in those answers that it's easy for us to assume that the ways of our age make more sense than the ways of God. But the argument of this passage is that God is the one who's truly wise, all-knowing, truly wise, and God's wisdom tells us how reality really is, even if it flies in the face of what we think we know and how we might try to describe our experience of the world. This passage is saying God tells the truth about the world in the true sense of truth, like true truth, or it's really real, or all those kinds of words. And if that's true, if God is wise like that, how can we learn to live in his wisdom, even when it cuts against the grain? Well, I want to offer a couple different answers to that question from this text. And the first one comes in chapter 12, verse 1. This is where the Apostle Paul says, I appeal to you by the mercies of God. He talks about presenting our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Now, the Apostle Paul has spent most of the first 11 chapters in this letter to the church in Rome describing or showing how Christ is the unveiling of God's righteousness. It's God unveiling what's really right about salvation and the world and even broader strokes. The way of salvation that has been built since the fall of man, it's filled out its form in Jesus. When we look at Jesus, we see what's most true about God's plan of salvation. And it reaches its purpose in all the nations. And part of the mystery in Paul's thinking in Romans is that God includes the Gentiles. What? This is crazy. But that's all in there. This is all part of God's wisdom, and all this shows the glorious wisdom of the Father. And here in chapter 12, verse 1, Paul writes that in light of all of that, in light of God's unveiling of his own righteousness and the rightness of his salvation plan, hey, we need to live a certain kind of way. If the gospel's true, chapters 1 through 11, then we're called to do life in a certain kind of fashion, 12:1 and further. Now, I think it's important for us to see in verse 1 that the words that are used are all within sort of semantic category of very, very religious language. It's all, the term I'd like to use is, it's all very cultic, not occultic, of course, but it's cultic. It's about religious ceremony. It's about presenting sacrifices. They're words about ceremonial acceptability. And explicitly, Paul says that all of this is our, the word that's here in verse 1, it's our, where did it go? It's our It's our spiritual worship, right? There we go. Sorry, I wrote down the Greek word, which is totally not helpful for everybody. Explicitly, Paul says, this is what my sentence says, explicitly, Paul says that all of this is our latreion. That's meaningless to most. The word here, here's what it is. The word here has to do with religious exercises or cultic duties. Okay, the word that's used there is about the stuff of religious ceremony. Now, I bring all of that up in order to point out that, according to this text, our response to the glorious and mysterious wisdom of God is to offer up our lives as an oblation, to live in God's wisdom. We have to recognize that the governing function, here's point one, the governing function of our lives is worship. Now, we've said that before. We say that a lot. We're worshipers, right? But the governing function of our lives, if we say the governing function of our lives is worship, it's to offer up ourselves as an oblation, then we need to make sure we recognize the corollary to that is that the function, the governing function of our lives is not finding our happiness. It's not about gaining success. It's not about wielding influence. It's not about self-improvement, even self-improvement with what we might think is virtuous. Now, I would argue that living out our lives as a sacrifice, living out our lives with the function of worship, will actually end in things like happiness. It will end in us improving. It will end in those things, even though we might need to tweak some definitions here and there. It will end in us understanding the realities of power and influence. It will lead to those things. Those things, though, are not the governing function. The governing function of our lives is worship. That means that the governing function of our lives, again, is not serving ourselves. Our lives are offered as an oblation to God, not as an offering to ourselves. We are not the center of the cosmos to which every other part of creation has to bow in submissive homage. That was a fun sentence to write. We are worshiping creatures. And that means that we are called to take our place humbly in God's order as worshiping creatures. Now that said, our place as worshiping creatures is also as bearers of God's image, and that is glorious. But if we're going to live in God's wise ways, we have to begin to revision our understanding of what we're about, to reform our self-understanding as worshipers. Fundamentally, we are worshipers of God and not servers of self. Now, as I say that, I've been reflecting on what it means for us as a group of people that are trying to follow Jesus. It's one thing to say, I wonder what that means for me. And that's important. But I've been thinking some about what would it mean for us to live out our lives as a congregation, as followers of Jesus. And here's the, you might think I've gone completely overboard, so hear me out here. That's always a fun warning, right, before I say that. Here's what I've had this image in my mind. You ready for this? I've been thinking in terms of what would it mean for us to live our lives kind of like we belong to a non-residential monastery. Okay? So some of you are going, oh boy. Sean's done. All right. No, here's what I mean. In an ideal monastery, I know monasteries had their problems, but in an ideal monastery, everyone had a job to do, right? There are patterns to monastery life that involve things like labor and recreation, that involve doing things, reflecting on things, that involve serving other people, that involve receiving from other people. In an ideal monastery, these things are going on, and in an ideal monastery, all of these things are organized around patterns of worship, times of the week, or times of the day, or times of the year. And all of these sort of habits of life are formed around worship. So what I've been thinking about is this. What if, now not that I want to be an abbot, every time I say that, I just think, Abbott. Anyway, those of you that have never seen Abbott and Costello, there you go. So I'm sorry. These are the thoughts that fly through, and I should just say, no, don't say it. But I didn't. I said it out loud. Anyway, as I've been thinking about this, what if we as a people as a community that's following Jesus, what if we had markers in our lives? These places in our days or in our weeks or in our years that all of the labor and the recreation, that the doing and the reflecting, the receiving and the giving, that those things sort of moved around these markers, these hinge points that form our life as a community, as a worshiping body. What if we had markers that built habits and reminded us of what we are doing in the world really and why we're doing them? I think that it would re-envision our understanding of who we are within the context of worship. You see, if we're going to live in the wisdom of God, we've got to begin to see ourselves as walking liturgies. As we're out and about in the world, around the people that we're around, and the work that we do, and the fun that we have, that we are, in a sense, walking liturgies that people can look at and see, this is what worshiping Jesus looks like. We have to see ourselves as that, to re-envision ourselves as that, as sacrifices that instead of being offered up in fire on the altar, are being offered up in the joyful doing of our lives before God. And before a God who knows what is really true about the world, about how it actually works, and loves us enough to include us in what he's doing in all reality. To live in God's wisdom, the governing function, that's point one, the governing function of our lives must be worship. Okay, now during the holidays, it's such a weird thing to say. During these holidays, many of you are going to make some treats for neighbors, like cookies and things like that. If you have extras and you need somebody to eat them, I'll help. But only if you need the help. If you don't, it's fine. But anyway, but during the holidays, many of you will make some treats. One of the treats that happens a lot comes from almond bark. Does anybody know what almond bark is? It's kind of like chocolate, but I think it's made with like vegetable fat or something like that. Anyway, I should have looked it up so I knew, but you see almond bark all the time. This time of year, at least, you go in the store because everybody's making candy for neighbors, and you can find these big blocks of almond bark. But you don't just take the block of almond bark, stick a bow on it, and say, Merry Christmas, right? I mean, I guess you could. I don't know who's going to chomp on that. But what you do is you melt it down, and then you put it into, like, you know, my mom used to have these little, they're metal or plastic little forms. You know, you pour the almond bark in, and then it becomes like a Santa or an angel or something like that. This almond bark has to take the form of something for the sake of delivering it out into the world and neighbors and things like that, right? Now, if we recognize that the governing function of our lives is worship, it makes sense that we ask the next question, well, okay, but what pattern does that worship take? What's the form of that worship? What's the mold that forms our worship, if you will, for delivery to our neighbors, however that might be said? And that answer is actually in chapter 12, verse 2, where Paul says we're not to be patterned along the lines of this age. Now, the ESV translates it there. It's a plausible translation. There's nothing wrong with it. Translates it, do not be conformed to this world. The word that's used there has less to do with the stuff of the world and more to do with the season, with the time that we're in. It's this time, this age. See, we live in a season or an age that projects, as we've already mentioned, certain values about the world, certain ways in which this age believes the world works. We live in an age that has certain ideas about how to have control. What is the real problem in the world? I mean, every age is trying to answer questions. You know, where are we? What is the problem? What's the solution? Some would add, what time is this? All these kind of things like that. Our age is presenting a certain set of values, certain answers to the questions of our hearts, certain projections about what the good life really is, certain ideas about what is actually good. Now, we know that. But we also know from Romans 1, 21 and following that when people lose sight of their function as worshipers, when people stop giving thanks, stop acknowledging their place as worshipers, that there's a darkening that happens, a downward spiral of thanklessness and worshiplessness. So that though in one sense everyone knows God, without acknowledging God, our ways of knowing become clouded. And so the answers of our age don't actually deliver on the promises that they make, because they're not seeing the world right. But the call of this passage is to know differently than that. The call of this passage is to a renewal of our knowing, a renewal of our mind, a renewal of our knowing so that we can understand what the will of God is. And the idea there is not so that we can understand, you know, do I wear the blue sweater or the khaki sweater today? It's to understand the ways of God. A renewal of our knowing so that we begin to see what is God up to? How is this fitting within the world that he made? It's that kind of understanding of the will of God. See, here's the thing, though. The point is that by a renewed knowing, we'll more and more understand God. But last week, remember, if you weren't here, I'll tell you again. But we've got to be careful not to think that knowing is just intellectual. Knowing in the scriptures is not only about, it's included in this, but it's not only about rational assent. Knowing in the scriptures is about intimate embodiment or enactment of realities. Knowing isn't just intellectual, we could say, it's also relational. Knowing has to do with what we love and who we love. So let's bring this to the end. I asked a question at the beginning of this point and I haven't answered it yet. So let's do this. Let's finally answer the question. We asked, what pattern must our lives take as we understand our primary function as worshipers? What's the mold that we're to be poured into so that we take the right shape? Well, this is where we intersect the sermon series I get to kick off today. The mold we are to take as worshipers, the form of our doing life, is actually the very mysterious, counter-conventional, this-age-defying ways of God. Like, the form of our actions is actually the very things that we struggle with. The ways that we're to live into life and live into this world, the form they take is actually those very things that we look at God and go, wait, you're doing what? Yeah, that's the form our lives are to take. God's sometimes frustrating ways are the pattern for how we engage this life. And those ways find their technicolor clarity in Jesus. Now, I suppose if you want to think about kind of practical application, I get to cheat a little bit this week, because over the next coming weeks, the preachers following me are going to talk about the ways of God. What is God doing in relationship to the outsider? How is God interacting with, I mean, Joseph? What is his point in this? But as we see the Lord at work in these places that he's doing things that are so kind of mysterious and weird and don't really seem like maybe I wouldn't do it that way. But what we're finding is that that's the pattern for our lives. How does God interact with the outsider? How does God respond to someone like Joseph? What is going on with God's response to the Holy Family, those other kids and other people in Jesus' family? In those things that we're going to see over the coming weeks, those are the patterns for us. Those are the ways that we lean into the world. The pattern of God's mysterious wisdom is the pattern for our lives because it reflects what's really true about the world. The pattern of God's mysterious wisdom is a pattern for our lives because it reflects reality in its truest sense. Now, sure, we can't do everything God does. It's true. He is infinite, we are not. But even in our finite dependence, the fundamental pattern of our lives is to reflect his image, to be about the kinds of things that God is about, to walk in the kinds of ways that God demonstrates, as those that are fundamentally worshipers. The pattern of our lives is the very same God that sometimes makes us kind of bonkers. Well, when, man, this is like Sean's sermon bingo goldmine today, isn't it? Sorry, ask me later. Because when one of my girls asks me, there you go. So I have to tell you real quick. Simon Nathaniel, this is the most endearing thing that's ever happened to me in my entire pastoral career, have created Sean's sermon bingo. So certain things come up, and anyway, so there you go. At one point, Nathaniel's going to jump up and say bingo, and I can't wait. Anyhow, get ready for this. You can mark it down. When one of my girls asks for a definition of a word, I may have told you this before, I usually point them to a very large dictionary on a shelf, and they hate it. It's big. It's so gloriously big. It's so big. And it's full of words, and they're so much fun. And words everywhere. That is not the response they prefer from me. If they come to me and say, Dad, what does this word mean? They don't want me to say, oh, that's a good one. Get the dictionary. What they really want is for me to either just tell them, it means this, or if I'm working on something, can just plug it into the computer because it pops up on the screen. Magic. And then they don't have to go hunt it down. So when I say, yeah, I'm not going to do that, even with the computer open sometimes, it's kind of obnoxious. But they're like, you've got the computer right there, just tell us. And I'm like, yeah, no, go look it up. It's super frustrating to them. They don't get, why won't I just tell them? But here's the thing. They want the answer, don't understand why, but I know something. I'm going to tip my hand out. Are you ready for this? I know that when they used a big dictionary, they're actually practicing spelling in a way, right? Because you've got to find it. I know that when they use the big dictionary, that they're going to have to learn a little bit about diligence and time and failure, right? Because you go looking for, oh, it's not here. And then finally I come over and go, yeah, it is. It's right there. Ah, so I know they're going to learn some things about time and failure and diligence. I also know when you go looking for a word in the big, huge dictionary, you know what you find? Yes, lots of other words. And you learn things you didn't set out to learn. It's glorious. I love the big dictionary. My girls hate the big dictionary. They might dislike me when I tell them about the big dictionary, but I know some things that they don't know. And in fact, it's really reasonable for me to tell them, use the big dictionary. Now that brings me, as we start wrapping up here, there's a word that we just kind of glossed over in verse 1 of chapter 12. And it's the word where the ESV here translates as spiritual worship. I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Now the word here, I love the ESV. These guys are smarter than me. But that's a possible definition. And it probably is included in the definition, I think. However, the Apostle Paul talks about spiritual in lots of other cases and never uses the word that's here. He usually uses a different word, and this is actually the only time this word comes up in the Apostle Paul's writing. And the word is, it might sound familiar to you, the word is logikos, kind of like logic or logos or something like that. Here's why I think that is helpful in the context of what Paul's doing in this passage. Other translators use the word reasonable, like sensible, like it makes sense. And I think that gets the point a little bit better. See, it makes sense for my girls to go along with my instructions, even though they're baffled by why I won't just plug it into the computer. And it's sensible for them. It's reasonable for them to trust that what I'm doing by sending them to the big dictionary, like that actually does make sense even if they're frustrated by it. And why? Because, I know some things that they don't know. I see some things that they don't see. Now, if that is true for a grumpy blockhead of a dad like me, how much more true is it of God? When he calls us to do things that don't seem like they make sense, when he tells us to pattern our lives in certain ways that just utterly cut against the grain of our age, and we think, what? Why? It's reasonable. It's sensible for us to offer up our lives as a sacrifice, even in this way, because of how wise he is. Oh, the depth of the riches and the wisdom and knowledge of God. It makes sense for us. It's reasonable for us to follow along with what God says because he knows things that we don't know. This morning, as we begin our way through Advent, would you be willing this morning to recognize that the governing function of your life is worship? Would you be willing to recognize that the pattern, the governing pattern of your life is actually God's ways? And that it makes sense because of how wise our Father is. Let's pray. Oh, how great is your wisdom and knowledge, God. How unsearchable are your judgments. How inscrutable your ways. May we be a people that submit to them, knowing that you love us, that you are for us, and you've demonstrated that in the giving of your Son. Help us today. In Jesus' name, amen.